What's up, you crypto heathens and DeFi degens? We got a heck of a show for you today. It is DeFi Tuesday, my friends. We're breaking down Premia Finance, Pendle Finance, Frax Finance, Coinbase versus the SEC, and more. Special guest, Charles DeFi, Austin Blockbytes joining the show, highly caffeinated, fresh out of daddy daycare. Stick around, hit the like button, subscribe to the channel. We love it. Welcome to Blockbytes Daily. Mikey, bring us in. What is up, gentlemen? What's happening?
Hello.
Bro, that intro was so good.
Killed it. It was. Daddy daycare is accurate.
How are things, man? It's good to be on with you.
Things are good, brother. Things are good, man. My daughter reminded me yesterday that she has cheerleading tryouts every day this week. Ooh, that blue is nice. Which totally screws everything up. You guys have no idea like what dinner time and bedtime is like with a 2-year-old and a newborn and the nine and 12-year-old. They pretty much take care of themselves, but yeah, shit is wild around the house, dude. And when I'm like somewhere else, my poor wife, it's just absolutely crazy. But you asked how I'm doing, and I was doing some research on this Ledger topic, which I know we're going to get into, and I am like beyond disturbed about this.
You
so beyond disturbed that we canceled our affiliate program with them?
Oh damn, bro.
Before the show, that's
how soothing me earlier.
Fucking disturbed. Funny. Yeah, there's a soothing part, and then there's a what the fuck part. Mm-hmm. There's a look. I got the shirt.
Oh, beautiful.
Somebody
play that video. Yeah, who's got the video?
Up. Come on.
See, as you can see, the more you fuck around, the more you're gonna find out.
My wife was like, "You're the biggest nerd I've ever met." And she's like, "I don't understand it." And I said, "Don't you know remember the unicorn chart where like how hot she is and how crazy she is?" And it goes, "Well, she knew that chart."
Yeah.
Like, well, this is the fuck around and find out chart. Same thing.
It's a fantastic shirt. Well, we got a lot to cover today, guys. We're going to get started. Welcome to DeFi Tuesday. Charles, good to have you. Corval, that mustache gets better every day. Let's jump in. So we're going to, I think let's address a couple of housekeeping things, and then we'll go into DeFi stuff, right? And I know that you're hanging out at Mr. Got Plenty's vault, and things are looking good over there. So
I was gonna say, are you in Walter White's fucking basement?
He's such a G.
quick bubbles glance, not too dissimilar from yesterday. Still looking at the same things that we talked about yesterday. BT scenario, we had 8 red days in a row. Had to go back to June 2022 to see that again. Things are ugly on the month. May has been tough. We are looking for retail earnings. I think target is tomorrow, and the debt ceiling drama still remains. So there's a lot of uncertainty in market, a lot of apprehension, I think, on risk on assets. I still think we probably see another leg down to 24, 25. We are outside of the symmetrical triangle that we have been holding for a while. And I'll probably just leave it there because I think we've got enough to cover. Austin, I don't know if you have anything you wanted to add on that, but we have
some interesting confluence. I'm gonna
take it.
Turn my screen up real quick. That's
my bad.
Let's put mine up. There we go. Oh shit, mine's hard to see because of these black candles. I'm sorry about that, guys. I should change that.
It looks cool.
Turn one of these off. Which one of these is messing my candles up? There it is. Okay, cool. So we have some interesting confluence happening. So you guys know about the head and shoulders. We've talked about it a bunch of times, right? You've got your left shoulder, your head, and your right shoulder. The way that you measure a head and shoulders is you go from the neckline to the peak of the head, right? Which is we could call it right there. We'll call it right there, 36-44, if we were to do so. If you take that down, now I'm going to make the assumption that this is kind of going to stretch out for a little bit, but that measured move will take us right down into this rising trend line here, like almost to the dollar. Very interesting.
What dollar?
It depends on how long it takes to play out. If it takes a long time, so right now it would take us into So we've got from here to here, which is, we'll call that $3,500. If we go from the neckline down, $3,500 would be right around there. So this is the assumption that we're going to kind of crab for a little bit and then hit it. Now we've got
23.6.
Yeah, give or take. Yeah, 23.6, yep. Which would probably, so it's going to look like a strong breach of 25.2, which is, you know, 25.2, 25.5 is a really strong level of support. However, I would guess it would just be some sort of a deviation. Would you get a very strong bounce because we have a lot of confluence around that area? And now, you know, we're like, I think you just mentioned, we're below the neckline right now, which is bearish. I mean, if we go back inside this range, we're just kind of going back into neutral,
yeah, sort of crab,
little crab territory. Yeah, there's nothing really there. So not all bad though. You know, sometimes BTC taking a breather is not a terrible thing, except right now alts are just getting licked. Yep. So, you know, pick your poison at this point.
Yeah, the total two looked ugly. We went over that last Thursday, I think. And BTCD creeping back up and alts are just getting crushed as a result. But, you know, we continue on and we've got some very interesting things to talk about today. And I think so there was a request from Lefty directly to us on Twitter addressing the SEC nonsense that's going on with Coinbase. And mm-hmm. when I mentioned housekeeping, I was kind of referencing just getting like this and the Ledger thing out of the way so we could get into the fun DeFi Tuesday stuff. But effectively, you know, Coinbase said to the SEC, to the courts, we need a response and we need it in a timely fashion and we need it by X date. And the SEC came back and said, we don't really care what you want, what you need. We are going to operate on our timeline. And we are going to, you know, this is the way things are going to be. Like, you are not going to force our hand, Coinbase. And obviously, the Coinbase's lawyer, Paul, came out with a pretty strong statement that says, you know, effectively that the SEC has formally explained its views in the court and that they're going to rule the crypto industry by, you know, by going after people as opposed to actually, you know, making public statements and having things be any type of clarity. And so, you know, I don't think, like, I haven't. Besides that, outside of like them, you know, operating on their own timeline, which doesn't surprise me at all, I don't have any other real key takeaways. Do you?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. There's a lot to this. There's a lot more to this. I mean, a judge ordered them to come back and give a response, and their response was not a yes or a no; it was a maybe. And if you go back in, you know, I would imagine if you go back in history, this is a very emboldened Securities Exchange Commission right now. Yep. Right. It's not they're spitting in the face of Congress. They're trampling over an industry and they're basically coming back with a big fuck you to a NASDAQ listed company who's just asking for something simple, regulatory clarity so that we can operate within the boundaries of the law. And their response was, we can't give you any regulatory clarity. That's going to take a number of years, but we will continue to enact enforcement actions to hint to you what's legal and what's not legal. That type of emboldened like response would only come from an agency that it's kind of like, I don't know how to put it. If you're a Biden, you go and you smoke crack and you take pictures of it and put on your laptop and you don't care because you're never going to get in trouble. That's emboldened, right? Like it's that type of, that's how they're coming at you is like, we know we have the backing from the top of the land. So screw you. We're going to basically do what we've been charged to do, which is not public. We haven't been publicly charged to do this, but privately from the administration, we've been charged to put our boot in the ass of this industry. And that's essentially what I read into with that because the SEC works, their mandate, you know, is they work at the behest of Congress. Like their laws have to be given to them by Congress. And it was very clear. Congress did not give them any guidelines for regulating this industry. They're taking that on their own.
It's kind of,
They're like the dude standing outside the club in a Hawaiian shirt and loafers telling the bouncer, like, wait till my dad hears about this, you know, just doing whatever he wants. And then going,
you can't do shit.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way that it should infuriate anyone. Now, here's the good news. Right? For If you want change, things have to expand to the point of enough pain that the people that can make the change are willing to take action. And that's the scenario that we're living under right now, right? If you want to, I've said this before, but if you want to lose weight, if you can do it when you're moderately overweight, good for you. I never could. I had to wait till I like looked in the mirror and went, I hate you right now before I would actually undertake a diet and like lose that weight, right? Like you've got to get so broke that you can't buy food before you get off your lazy ass and like really go do some shit. However, that's kind of the way things work. You've got to get really clear on what you don't want before you're willing to put in the effort pushing towards what you absolutely do want, right? And so I think we're kind of at that point to where like we're getting a clear demonstration of what we don't want so the people in power can move us towards what we do want. And we've said it before, say it again. Ellie broke this also, that there was a memorandum, maybe you call it, I'm not really sure, circulating prior to the, you know, the House Financial Services Committee rulemaking, whatever the hell it was the other day, saying, look, the Democrat position is the SEC has authority and that's the position that we're taking, right? So it's a party line. Bottom line is it's a party line.
That's right. Governments never move unless there's a crisis. Otherwise, they just play the party games. They play patty cake together, Democrats and Republicans. But, you know, Philip brings up a good point. Like, why would we don't really need Coinbase. We have Spirit Swap.
Dude.
Yeah, that's... Go ahead.
What's going on with Spirit
Swap? All I was going to say, you know... I would never, I guess I'm going to say it publicly now. This is something I would say in my private life, but like if I could have a choice of being surrounded by people that have had a near-death experience and survived it versus the alternative, people that have just lived a cushy life and never really had to like learn how to appreciate the little things in life, I will always take the former in that, right? Because there's just something about recognizing how important the little things are. Really, where I'm relating this is like the crypto industry in the United States is getting pushed towards the point of death, which if it survives, will galvanize it. It will harden it. It will put things in place to ensure that this horse shit never happens again. They're going to be fuck around and find out amendments made to the Constitution.
We have to survive the next 18 months. Pressure makes diamonds, but it is the pressure cooker is on full throttle. And you know, Ellie put out another tweet that was actually probably, I think, originally by Adam Cochran, but I don't know, you know, follow him on Twitter.
269 Adam. Tweet thread.
Yeah. this one was only five, but the SEC has filed 1,500 enforcement actions, 50 crypto related, and 50 new rules ranging from climate change to short selling to all these different stuff. It's like it's basically unprecedented amount of filings in that they've made compared to previous administration. So so anyway, that's what's going on. Not much we can take from it besides, you know, a whole lot of the same, like the same actions, the same, you know, decisions, the same ruling by enforcement that we've seen thus far continue. So let's hop over to Ledger real quick. So this article, I saw this morning and I was like, whoa, like this seems extreme, but like the little headline read, Ledger delivers update that might kill company. Austin, what do you have on this?
I got a lot for you, buddy.
What's going on exactly? Yeah.
So let's first talk about the official explanation from Ledger. And I was going to play this video, but it's a little bit, he's got a very French accent. He's a little bit difficult to understand. So essentially here's what Ledger did. And it became very clear to me as I was researching this, that what they're doing is they're kowtowing to the, you know, oh no, 24 words. How will I ever back that up crowd? And so essentially what they're doing with their newest firmware update is they're giving you an option. Now, this option is not toggled on by default, but they're giving you an option where they will basically shard your seed phrase to three different encrypted servers and back it up on your behalf. Now, you have to KYC, it's fucking ridiculous, and you have to turn it on. Okay. So first thing I want to do is I want to give you the official explanation from Ledger, just in all fairness, before we just make their butts bleed going over this, because this is such horseshit. All right. So self-custody is at the core of our offering, and your secret recovery phrase is securely generated on your device. We have no access to it. I believe them. This will never change. Ledger Recover, which is the service we're talking about, is an optional subscription for users who want a backup of their secret recovery phrase. You don't have to use it. You can continue managing your recovery phrase yourself if that's what you want, blah, blah, blah. So obviously Twitter just went bonkers with this, right? Because anyone that knows anything knows that you don't ever put your seed phrase into an internet connected device, right? That makes it hot, essentially. But even more concerning, now, you know, Ledger a while back, right? Anyone that was on the Ledger email list 3 years ago, I don't know about you guys, but I get text messages, spam text messages all day long that are phishing because they leaked my email and my phone number. And so they know, hey, this guy has cryptocurrency. And so it's random shit. I get three or four a day. I get my spam box is so freaking full. It's ridiculous. But here's the problem. A, they've built a back door now into the firmware, which has the ability to extract your seed phrase. Now, encrypted or not, it still has that ability, right? To transmit your seed phrase over internet connected devices to, I don't know, trusted third parties, not trusted third parties, who the hell knows? But they've lost the plot as far as I'm concerned. And I want to share some tweets. Some of them are funny. Some of them are disturbing. But like the more I read about this, and you can see in the DMs there, actually I have them open. I reached out to the Grid Plus guys and they said that they will get us something from the CEO directly addressing this. So if they get back to us, we'll read that to you. But a whole bunch of stuff here. So let's kick over to OXFUBAR. Stop using Ledger hardware wallets immediately. Migrate away from them immediately. They've shown nothing but gross incompetence and wild misunderstanding of their own purpose. And now they've publicly admitted to intentionally backdooring their own proprietary software or hardware. Stop using Ledger. So I want to be clear, for anyone that is currently using a Ledger, your Ledger is not at risk right now. Don't update the firmware, for God's sakes. Do not turn on the secret recovery phrase. Don't do any of that shit. Like, don't subscribe to this service. How this passed the PR test is absolutely beyond me because they are getting completely flamed right now. The fact of the matter is your seed phrase should never be on an internet connected device. It should never be transmitted over the internet anywhere, right? Once it's loaded on your device is just signing. For you, it's not transmitting your seed phrase anywhere. I want to kick over to our old friend Gabriel, who's just hilarious, and we should watch his videos.
I'm so hyped for this goddamn Ledger update. This is fantastic. Now we can easily share our private key with anyone from around the world. No more pesky fishers trying to steal from us. They'll just get it delivered directly to them. It's perfect. I'm so hyped for
that. And then this chick, I don't even know who she is, but her shit was really funny and I figured we would play it. So hang on, let me play this.
Dude, Gabriel does not miss a single event.
Work at a Ledger, true? Yeah, so the device sends encrypted shards of your seed to different companies if you do decide to use the service. So basically, you're fucked. All right.
How could you betray our trust like this?
Yeah, you know, we don't really have a great answer for that. So if you do decide to reply to our Twitter or leave a review, we're just going to delete it. And yeah, go fuck yourself.
And they also started hiding replies.
Really?
Yeah, on their tweet thread, like people just went nuts on them. So this is gross. It's just... Even if it's completely secure, listen to me here. Listen to me. There's an entire state-sponsored hacker group whose sole job is to steal your cryptocurrency. Where do you think all of their efforts are going to go now?
Yep.
What do you think? You're now, it's connected through, I guess, an API. Like, this is frightening. And even if it's completely safe... I saw a meme last night from the Bud Light thing. You guys know the Bud Light thing, right? Yeah. It was says, "Don't give me this in a bottle. I can only take it in the can." It was really fucking hilarious. Now I'm chuckling about it because he said that. But honestly, like I would, you know, I have a bunch of Ledger devices. I'm not going to use them anymore. I have a Grid Plus. I have a Trezor. I don't know about the Keystone. That's the one with the QR codes, blah, blah, blah. I don't use it. Grid Plus is my favorite, honestly. And they give you these really cool.
It's like an iPad. The thing about it,
well, so Grid Pluses are dope. They look like this.
Yeah. You have the screen. You can see what's going on.
But, it looks like you can render the device useless because you can store your key on this little card and you put card in and the device works for that seed phrase, or you put your other card in and the device works for that seed phrase. And these cards, you just lock them up and this thing is rendered useless. This thing has nothing stored on it whatsoever. And they put a wallet out with, I think it was 100 ETH or something on it. And they basically, before the device came out, they sent these cards out. And they said, "Hey, if you can hack this card and get the seed phrase off, you can have the 100 ETH." Nobody hacked it.
Nobody. That's awesome.
Yeah. Grid Plus, like a lot. And they're like a newer company. That's why, you know, I also reached out to Trezor for a comment. Didn't hear back from them. But Grid Plus was like, "Yo, we'll give you, the CEO will reach out to you in a minute." So anyhow.
Real cypherpunks generate their private seed by hand. With their own skull. They run the algorithm on paper.
They just cut some blood and squeeze it on a stone and poof.
It's a freaking slide rule. It's cypherpunks.
Yeah, you get it.
In summary of the story, real quick, just to make sure I understand, this guy right here, this Ledger, right?
It's currently safe.
It's currently safe, but when I download this update.
Which you don't have to do.
Which I don't have to do. There will be the option to allow it to shard out my phrase.
So the way that I understand it is you have to toggle on this subscription service, enter your payment information because you're going to pay for it, and KYC. And once you've done that, then they'll apparently store this data for you. But like, again, it's still built into the firmware itself. Like it's built in. Like,
but if, yeah, the problem is in the hardware itself. This is a possible function of the hardware itself.
Here's how you could keep your Ledger safe. Okay.
So I could push an update to it.
Do not use Ledger Live. Delete Ledger Live from your device because that's how it updates. And use it in its current form, just with your MetaMask or Rabi to sign transactions. You will have no problem. You have not updated the firmware. It does not have the current backdoor on there. No harm, no foul. Right, you're good. You've just got the Ethereum app on there. You keep rolling. However, just the simple fucking fact that they did this, and like, I don't know how drunk they were or like what the hell was going on that made them think this was a good idea or think that this would not be like, this could be the end of Ledger. Like if you lose trust in your hardware wallet, see you later, dude.
They should have hired me, bro. I would have had a simple solution here. Check this out. This is how we do it. This is how we do it, right? Because this is for adoption. Like they want to make it easy for you to like back up your key if you're like a tech noob, right? What you do is you launch a separate product line, baby. You launch a separate product line, and then you don't lose the trust. You got the newbies coming in.
Actually, that's a very reasonable solution.
You don't even need to redesign anything. It's probably the same thing, and then you just change this to like blue.
Exactly. Blue. Yeah. Any color you want.
The baby version.
Phillip,
that's like a legitimately good idea.
They cannot read your seed from the device. I'm full of them, guys. And according to them, even after this update, they cannot ever read the seed from the device. Like, obviously, this has to be, you know, they would have had to encrypt this in a big way. Here's the rub. Let's say everything Ledger is saying to you is true, which I believe it probably is. I believe they believe it, right? A, they've already leaked all of my fucking information once. And secondly, there are state-sponsored actors whose sole purpose it is to find a way to steal your shit. Do you think there's any more worthwhile cause than trying to hack into getting into the Ledger server with seed phrases? I'm out, dude. Like, I'm not even playing that game.
Even introducing something adjacent to this is like so ridiculous. And I can't believe that they thought that they could do this
and not like, did they think that they weren't going to get insane backlash? Like, how out of touch with the industry do you have to be able to be like, oh yeah, people will like understand, like, oh, they don't need to do this, but it's an option. It's like, dude, obviously everyone's going to freak out, and rightfully so. Yeah.
I mean, you fundamentally just went against everything that you created over the last however many years that they've been in business. Like, yeah, that's
literally.
So, hey, I do want to reference. So Ledger aside, you heard what not to do. I think we're good on this. Like, well, the Shimmer speculation comment. So we have an AMA in the Touchpoint Discord tomorrow with Austin. Do you want to give some background on the AMA and then?
Well, there's no point. Nobody watching can get into the Touchpoint Discord.
Oh shit! For real?
It's for projects only. It's not an open Discord. Nice of you to share, but it doesn't matter.
Corval, let's launch Corval Coin.
We're just chatting with a bunch of the projects that are building over on Shimmer. Touchpoint, for anyone that doesn't know, is like the organization within Shimmer / IOTA that supports people that are building on Shimmer. So we're only going to talk to the projects tomorrow. It's not like a like we can do one in the IOTA Discord if we want to, but this one is specifically for the project.
More so, man, like who's going to be there, but that's cool.
What do you mean? I don't know. I don't honestly know who's going to be there.
All right.
I'm so confused. we're so confused right now.
Clearly the plot has been lost.
Hey, let's talk to Mr. Cool. Got Plenty real quick. Yeah, this is a really, really important one. So the Ledger will not stop working. The only thing that Ledger, the company, maintains are the updates and Ledger Live, right? And somebody said earlier, you can't stay on an old version of Ledger. You totally can. I have ledgers that I have not updated in years, and if I plug them in, they will work. You can totally stay on an old version of the firmware with no problem. You'll just keep the older version of the apps.
The new apps.
Yeah. Right. So you may not, like, if you have an old version of the Ethereum app, you may not have EIP 1559 on there. Or if they institute proto dank sharding, which is going to be the name of my next kid, you may not have that on there, but you'll have the older versions and they'll still continue to work with any network that's compatible with those older versions, which is pretty much all of them. Mr. Got Plenty, you're a G, bro. You know, we love you. We talk about you when we're offline. I say shit like, yo, I'm bringing the heat today because I got plenty and shit like that. And we just crack up at your comments. You're awesome.
We're always scheming on how to break into Mr. Got Plenty's vault, how to get Mr. Got Plenty's money. Plotting and
scheming. Oh, man. All right. Well, let's get into DeFi Tuesday. 27 minutes later, we're here. And I'm excited about it. And Charles, explain to me proto dank sharding. And then we'll jump in.
The more you fuck around, the more you're gonna find out.
No, totally kidding, man. Hear about
premium. That was awesome.
And yeah. So, you know, I guess number 485 market cap out there. Looks like they are like similar to most alts, down almost 90% from a year ago's high. And so I'll let you take it, bro.
Yeah, and okay.
Tabs, that's on you. I don't have any tabs for you.
It's okay. I've got a couple tabs. Well, I've got a tab, but I did want to preface it. I'm already nervous because of Mr. Got Plenty. He's gonna I gotta make this explanation good. So this one is a real doozy. Because options are really complicated and we're definitely not going to be able to cover everything that Premia is doing. They're doing a lot of things, but I'm hoping that this will be kind of a primer for people to maybe want to learn about options more, learn about Premia more, because I highly recommend diving into DeFi options. It's a rabbit hole and it's awesome. So, okay. Just to start it off, here's the gist of what options are. They are contracts. They give the buyer the option of either buying or selling an asset at some predetermined price. Call options give you the right to buy an asset. That would be if you're bullish. Put options give you the right to sell an asset. That would be if you're bearish.
Checks out.
Yes. Okay. So, like, for example, a call option, if you have an asset that's worth $90, you think it's going to go higher. And you think it's going to go higher than 95, you could buy a call option that gives you the option of buying the asset at $95 at a later date. And if it goes above 95, you can buy that for 95, and then you make the difference in profit. And the option, the other option is put options, where you can sell an asset for, you know, higher than it might be. Now, there's a couple different types of options. There are American options, which allow you to exercise at any point up until the expiration date. So you can exercise them anytime you want. Those are more common in the Western Hemisphere. There's European options also, which are more like futures, where you have to exercise it at the date. So it doesn't give the option buyer a lot of leeway there, but those are the different types of options. Premia specializes in American options, so you can exercise them at any time. And I kind of just want to highlight, I'm not going to talk about the token too much, but I want to highlight just what they're doing and why I think Premia is the premium options protocol.
Where are they building?
Where are they building? They're on Arbitrum. They're on Arbitrum. They're also on Mainnet. Yeah, but their V3 is solely on Arbitrum. So Arbitrum gang, roll up, check it out.
Can I clarify one thing with you real quick, please. Charles? Because I have a very small understanding of options, but I do think it's a topic that confuses a lot of people. And so, like, if I were to put a, you know, exercise a put, right? If I were to buy a put, let's say I buy BTC at 15,000. And I want to get an insurance policy against Bitcoin dropping to 10,000. I might buy a put option at 15,000 saying, okay, I want to protect myself on downside. So I'm willing to buy this little insurance policy over here that gives me the next 45 days to be able to sell at the price that I bought it at, right? Is that a pretty accurate description or one way that you might use it?
Yes, exactly. And options are mainly used for hedging. For sophisticated actors, they use them for hedging their portfolios. A lot of, you know, retail and degens will buy them for speculation. But when you get into the upper echelons of trading, they're mainly used for hedging. And the history of options is actually really cool. They started with like old farmers who were like hedging their crops for like a down year. Yeah, they go back to like 1500. It's crazy. I read this really cool.
That onions. True. Corner in the onions market, was that options, Corval?
Yeah, that was an options. Well, that was like a futures contract thing.
Was it the Duke brothers over here?
Yeah. Anyway, Charles, you also can't trade movie tickets for a similar reason. Movie ticket or movie futures. But I wanted to just clarify something. So, like Austin and Charles are talking about here, the idea that like they're the sophisticated actors like trying to hedge their money. So when you're like buying options, the closer it comes to the strike date, that's like when you start to see like real profit, because it's like big guys that are like, I'm going to lose like a shitload of money. I need an option to be able to offload my asset at a price that isn't like completely fucked right now. Like if I had bought Bitcoin at 15,000, or I'd shorted Bitcoin at 15,000, right? So I owe someone Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is now 25,000. If I can get a put that is at around like 17,000, then I'm not as boned as I was.
Well, you'd actually get a call around 17,000.
Yeah, call. Yeah, the right call. Put is the right to sell. I always get them mixed up, but yeah, you get what I'm saying. Yeah.
No, so, they get really confusing really quickly. So, Clay, what were you going to say?
So, like, what are they doing that's cool, that's unique, that's DeFi Tuesday? Like, outside of having a dope looking Daft Punk, like, space band,
it's cool.
Like, they're going to roll Molly and go to an EDM show in Vegas, which I respect. What are they doing that's super, super dope on Arbitrum? Because there's other option competitors out there also on Arbitrum. But anyway, go on.
There are. Okay. So, a little bit more prefacing. I'm sorry. To go to the other side of the trade, there are people who obviously are selling the options, which is also called underwriting. So they take the opposite position to the buyers. So if you're buying a call option, there's someone on the other side of that trade who is selling you a call option, and they are bearish, because if you exercise, they have to forfeit those assets to you. So I just wanted to highlight the sellers of options. Now in TradFi, obviously, you have market makers in the middle just like with spot trading, of market makers who are buying and selling options from participants constantly. In DeFi, again, just like with spot trading, you have pools. So you have pools of assets that traders are trading against. And options pools, the LPs, are the ones who are selling the options to the buyers. So as an LP in an options pool, you are providing liquidity for options buyers to be able to come in and make a trade. And this means that you are taking somewhat of a directional bet, because if you are providing liquidity for, say, the Arbitrum call pool, that means that you're selling calls on the ARB token, and it means you're bearish on Arbitrum, because if people are exercising their options, they are taking money out of the pool that you've provided for. So that is the difference between in DeFi and TradFi. And here we're going to get into why Premia, I think Premia is based, because pricing options is really, really tricky. In TradFi, there's a couple options models that are used. There's like something called the Black-Scholes model, which is the most popular. There's also like the binomial options pricing model. And these models work pretty well in traditional finance, but they don't work so well in DeFi because of some assumptions that are made in traditional finance, like market efficiency, like the risk-free rate, which we don't really have in DeFi. The risk-free rate in TradFi is known. And there's some distribution of the under the returns of the underlying asset. Anyways, there are some assumptions that are made that make these models effective in TradFi, but when you just port them over to DeFi directly, it doesn't really work. And so the goal of a protocol in DeFi is to, an options protocol, is to provide the right space that options can be priced correctly. Now, when options started in DeFi, a bunch of these protocols were taking small modifications of like the Black-Scholes model and kind of, just sort of taking a very similar approach to what's going on in DeFi or in TradFi. And the result was mispriced options. Now, what mispriced options results in is either, so the market skews to one side. So either people buying options are paying way too much, or they're underpriced and LPs are getting wrecked because people are just coming in and scooping up all the liquidity in the pool for really, really cheap because the options are underpriced. And what that results in is LPs bearing most of that, because obviously option buyers are not going to take trades that they don't think are in their favor. So they're most likely going to be trying to buy underpriced options. Mm-hmm. And it results in markets that have high demand and low liquidity, or a bunch of capital sitting in a pool that's not doing anything. And so the point is that LPs were getting wrecked. And this is the basis on which Premia was created. They want to protect LPs by creating a model that is pricing options correctly. Now, I'm sorry I'm getting a little bit into the weeds here, but what they've done is they have something called the C level, and that is specific to Premia. And the C level is a variable. It's a metric that measures the supply and demand in the pools. Now, say if there's a market, say the ARB call market or something, and a bunch of people want to buy ARB calls. They're buying up all these calls. Demand is really high. The C level is going to get raised because the demand is really high. And that means options are going to be more and more expensive. So as people are buying, as demand is going up, options are getting more expensive. And that means that more LPs are going to provide liquidity because they are getting paid the price of the option. And so if they're getting more expensive, it incentivizes LPs to come in and supply liquidity. So that's the first thing that Premia is doing that a couple other protocols are also doing. But they've got this supply demand.
So Charles, simply put, they've solved a market dynamic issue, which is pricing options in a traditional system with a bunch of information that from a TradFi perspective we have, from a DeFi perspective, we have some of it doesn't work the same way. Like you can see here on this call put option, the price is 25.8% apparently above market price level, which means that C level functionality you're describing is jumping in and doing its job. Is that effective?
Yes, exactly. And thank you, Nietzsche, for highlighting that. I forgot to mention that right at the beginning, but people who are buying option pay a premium to the sellers, and that is the price of the option. So when you're buying an option, you have to pay an upfront cost to buy it. And then if it doesn't get exercised, the seller just keeps the premium. Mm-hmm. So that's what LPs are hoping for. They want to provide liquidity. They want to collect these premiums, and they don't want the options to get exercised because then they just keep the premium, and that's their profit.
Can I ask you a quick question,
yes.
Charles? Why is it, and I'm sure the answer is very simple and my smooth brain is just not comprehending it, but why is it that they have a put pool and a call pool segregated from one another, as opposed to having puts and calls in the same pool and just having the small delta between the two being the risk? Does that make sense, what I just said to you?
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean, I guess they could. I think it probably is to make the UI more intuitive, because they would have to separate them anyways, because buyers obviously have to specify which kind of call they want to buy. And the people providing liquidity, they also have to specify that, because they are selling a certain type of option. So I guess they could kind of put it all in one, but then you'd have to specify it anyways. Mm-hmm. I don't see how that would work. That's a good question,
only
though.
Because it seems to me, if the market runs hard in a single direction, like you see that there's a 25% premium on calls, which means people are buying up, they're going long. No,
yeah,
people are going long. There's more buys on the calls than there is on the puts. So that means it's driving the price up. Am I correct? Yeah. So that people are more bullish on Arbitrum than they are bearish in this option scheme that we're looking at right here. And so it seems to me that if the market does run hard and you get everyone in profit, right, or a lot of people in profit, then it puts these LPs at a greater risk, because they have to now cover all of these. Like if we think of options like an insurance protocol, like if I'm paying $300 a month to Geico to insure my car, but I'm actually betting that I'm going to wreck my car. Right. And you've got 1,000 people that wreck their car at the same time because traffic. So I'm giving a really bad example right now.
Hurricane insurance would be better.
But this is kind of like it's an insurance policy, right? You're betting one way or another.
Yeah. So, okay. So here's the sort of addressing that question. Premia allows buyers to specify any strike price and any expiration date they want, which is another feature of Premia that is not available on most options protocols. You can specify, you can construct any type of option you want, and you can pay for it with any token. So they've got a swap feature underneath that. You don't have to pay for it in the underlying asset. You can pay for it in any token, and you just specify, you build your own option. And so you've got all these, like, you've got all these different options in that pool, all these different strike prices and maturities, all these different options in that pool. So it's not one option per pool, which means it doesn't mean that LPs are going to be taking on the risk of one option. It's spread out over multiple options, and those options, like the market is going to converge on, I don't know, there isn't really a case in where price action gets so crazy that LPs, like the whole pool gets lost. And there's probably something I'm missing there, gets wiped out. But the incentives are directed in a way that you get this array of different strike prices, different maturities, where the LPs are not going to be taking on the risk of one particular type of option.
Can I ask you? Go ahead, Clay.
Well, wouldn't you have to separate the pools because you're trying to like do two separate, like your outcomes, the goals of what you're trying to do with calls and puts are two opposite things. So like if you were bearish on ETH and bullish on LINK, then you would underwrite a call in like ETH DAI by depositing ETH. Like basically there has to be two separate pools because you're trying to hedge two different sides of two different events.
Yeah, I get that point. But like, if you look at, let's say a a market making forex broker, right?
Right.
Let's take Gains Network for a second.
Yeah.
Right?
That's kind of where I figured you were going to go. Yeah.
Let's take Gains Network. They're a casino. You're playing against the house. There's not Gains Network for long and Gains Network for short. Yep. There's Gains Network. If you've got 100 longs and 80 shorts, then your risk is the 20. That's your risk. That's the difference, right? Because they're going to offset one another. And that was my point. If you had gains for long and gains for short, then gains for long, if the market runs hard long, it could blow up. It could suck everything out of the pool. And really what I wanted to ask you, Charles, was for the people watching, because we should probably keep skipping ahead. How can people watching make money on this? Like, where's the action item here?
Right. Okay. The action item is Bear Bull made a great point there. I was going to get to the vaults. So as I was saying, as an LP in a pool, you are taking a directional bet. And so for people who aren't familiar with options, they don't want to expose themselves to the risk of taking a directional bet with an option. They have these things called smart vaults, which were built by Knox, KNOX, on top of Premia's AMM, they simulate covered calls and cash secured puts. Basically, the bottom line is that with vaults, hold on, I had some notes here that I would like to look at. The pools, you're taking on more risk. You're underwriting the full book of risk of all the options being sold. With the vaults, they auction off options in a way that the sellers, the people who are depositing into the vaults, already know all the options that are being sold, and they meet a certain risk profile. And then for the buyers, the benefit is that they can buy in quantity and not worry about price impact, because they're just going to sell a number of options anyways, and you can just buy all of them without worrying about you suffering a price impact from buying a bunch from a pool. So yeah, it's a little bit complicated, but the bottom line is that vaults are less risky forms of just being able to collect premiums from people buying options and not worrying about taking so much of a directional bet. So like I said,
final question there, Charles.
Yeah.
Is it true that like for the LPs, I mean, they're, you know, with leverage trading or a perps platform, I mean, it's common knowledge that like 90% of trades are going to lose, like, or a lot of trades are going to lose. Mm-hmm. Are they taking kind of the same bet if you're providing liquidity here that the options are not going to be exercised and that the premium that they pay is just going to go straight to the LPs?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, like if all options traders were, if the rate of success was 90%, I don't think anyone would be LPing.
Right.
But the assumption is that a lot of traders are going to lose, and you're just going to be collecting premiums. Some will win, but it'll be offset by the ones who lose. Now, okay, before we move on, I'm so sorry. Literally covering this protocol would take 2 hours, but I just want to highlight one thing. The other main thing that they've done is they have built themselves a volatility oracle. And that's the other way that their model is actually correctly pricing options. One of the inputs in pricing an option is implied volatility. It's really, really hard to estimate implied volatility. A lot of protocols, they just put in a base implied volatility, some arbitrary number, and they let the market work it out. And it involves, and it results in LPs losing money. Premia is the first team ever to build a volatility oracle, and they take prices from super liquid options markets off chain, and they feed it into their model. They partnered with Chainlink, and yeah, I just wanted to highlight that volatility oracle because it's the first one in DeFi, and it's open source. People in other DeFi teams can use it and read their docs and check it out because it's really cool.
Nice.
Yeah,
dude, you're so freaking smart, Charles, man. I had a
quote from Taleb for you, Charles, when describing like options writers, the underwriters for options from Taleb. It's options writers eat like chickens, but shit like elephants, meaning they profit very regularly from people buying options, that premium. Yeah. But when they have to pay out, they have to pay out a lot. They lose a lot. That's like the risk profile. Yeah. And then it's the opposite. You're rarely going to win with options, but when you do win, you win big.
Yeah.
And someone's point.
Yeah.
This is just like sophisticated gambling in some ways. If you're not getting an option for a specific reason, like say covering a large position, it is just sophisticated gambling.
Yeah, exactly. And my whole point was that I think Premia is protecting their LPs the most out of all options protocols. And LPs are the backbone of any AMM, right? Their LPs are taking just less, they're getting compensated more for their risk. Mm-hmm. And that was my whole point. So definitely look into Premia, check out DeFi options. I hope that this made you interested in it because it's, they're a great.
Dude, that was awesome. Awesome. You know what I love the most about that, Charles? I don't know about you guys. I had some really good friends that were Canadian, and my experience with Canadian people is they're the nicest people on the entire planet. So like when you say, I'm sorry, I'm just like, he can talk for the rest of the hour. I don't even care. Just let him keep talking. I don't even care.
I don't know, man. Our government's kind of giving us.
Trudeau excluded, but you know, Canadian people are super kind.
That's a hard thing to explain, and you did a good job, sir. So, Corval, are we going to put you on deck? Are you
next for my presentation?
Pendle Finance, yeah?
Yeah, so Pendle. Pendle is pretty cool, I guess.
See, as you can see, the more you fuck around, the more you're going to find out.
I love these intros.
Yo, so where are they building? Like, give me some basic facts before you just throw it all on me.
Okay, so Pendle is basically doing bond stripping on crypto assets. Now, bond stripping is it's a thing from traditional finance when you take a bond and you strip the yield off the bond to separate it from the underlying assets. So what you can imagine here is, you know, when you do that, you end up with two separate assets. You end up with the yield, which is the coupon rate, and you end up with the bond, which is the underlying asset. So how this works for Pendle, right, is you come in with a yield-bearing asset, say like staked ETH. You deposit that in here, and they're going to split it up between the yield that you're going to get from staking your ETH and your underlying ETH. And they've created a marketplace so that you can make essentially bets on whether or not you think the value of the yield is going to go up or down, right? Pretty simple, right?
Like we just talked about a little bit, kind of.
Yeah, kind of. It's a lot different than options because you're actually holding an asset. And how this works is it's pretty simple. They have a really great introduction here. So if I fail you in some way, but you still get intrigued, come here and check out their learn thing. It'll walk you through step by step. But basically what's happening here is you've got an underlying APY, and that's like the actual APY that you're getting from staking, in this case, ETH and wrapped ETH together, right? About 3.29%. The implied APY is what, this is where it gets interesting, is what the Pendle market is saying that that people think the APY is going to be. Because why would I strip my yield, right? If I think the yield is going to be fine as it is, if it's going to be steady, I wouldn't strip the yield. I would just hold the asset, the staked asset. But I come to Pendle because I think that the APY is going to go up or going to go down. So if I think it's going to go down, what I would do is I would stake in here. I'll pull out my principal. And then I would sell the long yield APY. Because then I would get more money from someone just paying me for my APY if I think it's going to go down or if it's going to go up. I don't remember. if I think I'm going to get more money from someone just paying me for the yield, then I would just do that. And that's pretty much it. It's pretty simple, I think. So, but let me get some questions.
I have a question for you. So, and I asked you this on our planning call, but I want to ask it to you again because I did a video on this a while back and was kind of forced into learning a little bit about it. Not this one, but you remember the guys at Revest did that thing where All right. If you've got $100 in, let's say, Phantom USDC LP tokens, and over the course of the year, that $100 is going to earn 19% or $19. Somebody can come in and buy that yield from you at, let's say, $15, right? Your LP remains locked up and they get all of the yield. It just goes to them. So they kind of the reason I'm likening this is because they were the first time in my brain that somebody separated the yield from the principal as two different assets, one being your principal and one being a marketable future yield that hasn't come to fruition yet. And so you explained it to me that there's the yield token and the principal token. Can you explain that a little bit and how that makes this? There's a game theory behind this, which is what is making this so successful.
Yeah. So when you come on here, right, you can either buy the yield token or the principal token of any of these assets. And they call the principal token a fixed APY because that's only claimable. Let's say, think of this like a bond, when the bond expires after when it matures. Each one of these has a different maturity date. So this is going to mature December 25th, 2024. So like just under 2 years. So if I think that the yield on ETH is going to be like, if I think the yield on ETH on the staked asset is like less than what it's worth now, like I can buy just the asset stripped of its yield, and then when that comes to maturity, I can just get that asset back one-to-one. If I like the yield, I can buy the yield and just hold that at a premium and have that stream to me as it matures, like I'm just getting the coupon without holding the asset underlying it.
And what so, that looks like, oh sorry, go ahead.
So the price of each of those assets is dependent on the supply and demand of people buying and selling these assets. So they're very variable. Like you can lock in a very good price for a fixed APY if it's oversold. Like everyone is just selling their staked ETH, then you can buy it very cheap here, stripped of the yield.
On the Pendle site, one part of what this looks like is if I were to come and buy ETH, it's going to give me the option of ETH minus 4%. And I will receive that ETH on the 25th of September, 2024 or something like that, right? So it's not that I'm buying ETH for $1,800 plus a 4% yield. It's that I'm buying ETH at current price minus 4% from current price.
100% correct. That's exactly it.
Okay. All right. And also, it should be noted that on here, you've got various forms of staked ETH, which are offering different APYs. Now, this is important because obviously staking ETH on the ETH network, the Ethereum network, is going to give you a relatively fixed APY, barring transaction costs and fees that go to the validators and things like that. So are they, hope I'm not throwing you for a loop here, but are they taking like the Anchor ETH or the Lido ETH, the ST ETH, and are they farming it in a particular place that's earning them additional yield? Like, because I know Lido sometimes will give you Lido incentives, or Anchor might give you Anchor incentives. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're bringing, when you're depositing in here, you're bringing in the receipt from wherever you staked it. So if I've staked it in Lido, I'm depositing it in here and it's taking the Lido like APY. So you're also kind of taking bets on like each of these different staking services, like how much yield you're expecting them to give you. And if you expect that yield to maintain its rate, increase or decrease.
What I find most interesting about both of these is that we are clearly embarking upon very sophisticated financial products being deployed in a, you know, pseudo decentralized way without the barriers to entry that traditionally, you know, to get into if it were up to Gensler, none of us on this show would be able to play with these products. Right.
Yeah.
Because he'd like to bar you unless you have 100 million and, you know, an 8-foot long, but I find it to be very interesting that DeFi is progressing to the point of these very complicated products. And what I find even more interesting is they're getting adopted. It's not that like people are throwing these things out and all of the apes are going, I don't understand how this works. Like people are actually taking the time to educate themselves enough to use these products. And I think that bodes well for our industry just kind of as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And, to Philip's point, I mean, these products that are now being released are the bare bones of what they are. Like, my point is that they're going to, a lot of the complications are going to be abstracted away, or
there will be more protocols built on top of these foundations that will allow DeFi to grow a lot more. Like the separating the yield from the underlying, what we were talking about last week with GammaSwap, being able to provide a market for volatility for people to be able to buy exposure to go long volatility with Premia, like these products are just, they are huge in TradFi. And for DeFi to be able to like create these markets is just, it's essential for DeFi to be able to grow, and it will bring insane amounts of liquidity into the system, because like there's just certain things that you can't do in DeFi that you can do in TradFi, and those things are slowly being stripped away with these kinds of innovations. So yeah, these are like the foundations of what will allow just more things to be built on top. And yeah,
and I think for people watching, like a complete understanding of how the whole protocol works is not really necessary. But if somebody watching learns how to hedge their buys against market downside and just gets good at that one aspect of options, you've won. You've got something. You know what I mean? Or if somebody mm-hmm. learns how to purchase Ethereum for 4% under market price, even though it's going to expire in, you know, 13 months from now, or 15 months from now, or whatever, mm-hmm. but you're long Ethereum, and we've got the halving coming up. So you're going, okay, well, if I can buy this under market price, I'm willing to go ahead and wait and let that expire. Like, even if you've got that one little tool in your bucket that you can call mm-hmm. on later, because we're going to have other protocols where you're going to plug that in and you're going to go, you know, what the hell? This is really like, you know, it's enhancing my experience with this. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. It just to make this even more clear, I like to think of it as like in the extreme cases for how this works. So let's say you have, so this Starfire ETH WETH pool, right? 15% APY, underlying APY. That's what you're getting from staking this on Aura, right? Now, to me, and I think for a lot of you, you would be like, that's insane. There's no way they can continue to pay 15.3% on ETH for like 3 years or whatever. So that gives you like a massive discount on ETH because it's stripping away 15% of the value off of this. So while you do have to wait, you do get this at a pretty cheap price.
Yeah, and you can lock that in.
And then, yeah, you lock that in. You lock that in at that discount. And then also, because you're not locked into these PT or YT assets either, you can then sell them again later. So let's say, you know, this eventually flips, you could just sell, you could sell your PT again and buy the yield if you think the yield is going to be steady. It's pretty nice. It takes a little bit of working your head around, but it is a lot more simple than it might seem at first. It just takes a little time to play with. So I think, yeah, this does play a component in more sophisticated strategies, but there is some utility for someone who just is playing around and trying to figure out how to work.
So the options are buy an asset at a discount mm-hmm. and lock in the APY that currently the market says it's generating, or bet that the APY is going to increase and be able to buy the yield tokens at a discount now to get that increase in APY later. Yeah, nice. That's right. Awesome. I'm looking at this and I'm thinking about ERN. Mm-hmm. Not to shill Ethos Reserve, but yeah, like you know, being able to strip the yield from the principal ERN would be really cool. I want both these protocols to launch on Optimism, so the White Masons can build on top of them. Because
I mean, the underlying thing to me here is, and we had Justin Bieber on the show explaining Ethos Reserve many moons ago, but his bullish thesis on the space as a whole is that liquid staking derivatives are going to change the game, that there's going to be things like Pendle that come in and build primitives on top of the fact that you have this interest-bearing asset that can be separated from principal, and you can do all these really unique things with them, and that this will be the fastest growing space. This is what will usher in the billions of dollars in liquidity for the future across all different, you know, proof of stake chains, depending on your asset class, whatever you're interested in. They all have, you know, some type of yield bearing asset in, you know, staked ETH, or, you know, on, if it's Phantom, it's SFTMX, whatever it is. That's what's going to change the game for DeFi. We're seeing it play out, as Justin described, I think across many different protocols, and the liquid stake derivative is certainly the sort of the mechanism for us to get there. And so would you agree with that, Charles?
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Yeah, yield-bearing assets and being able to build on top of yield-bearing assets are like the foundation of TradFi is the risk-free rate. Mm-hmm. And if we can establish some sort of risk-free rate such that, you know, primitives can be built on top of it, then that's a huge step forward. Sorry, one of my roommates' birthdays is today in there.
I think Mr. Gotplenty's got a good question here. So I believe that traditional finance is bad and it sets up for the average guy to lose. Should we be bringing these things into crypto? Option calls, puts, bond stripping. Crypto is supposed to be different, but is it really? So I would say that the issue with traditional finance generally is the middlemen and the operators of the markets. So I think the promise of crypto is more so that you don't have to rely on these trusted people who often are manipulating markets to their own benefit. Now, we still do see a lot of market manipulation on the crypto side, but we have the tools to kind of remove that aspect. These kinds of more sophisticated financial tools generally are actually pretty good for a market. The more you have, like, the healthier your options market, your futures market, the more stable actually your market becomes overall, because people can take these bets and you find like an actual true price easier. The classic example is like the farm goods thing. Like, aside from the Onion King, futures have actually been very, very helpful for the health of like farmers in terms of like making sure that their assets are properly valued and that they can continue to operate.
So
go ahead, Charles.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to add on to that. I completely agree. I think the tools themselves aren't bad. It's when you get these like dark markets, opaque markets that no one can really access unless you're in the know, and mm-hmm. not having inclusivity with like everybody being able to participate in these markets. And then, you know, people who are creating the markets undertaking illegal activity, and that activity not being seen by the rest of the market. And
Austin, were you gonna say something? Because there's a couple things in Charles' statement that need to be pulled out, but you look like you were gonna hop in.
Dude, if I was gonna say something, as soon as I don't say it, it's gone, baby. Okay. I don't know what the hell was going through my brain. I gotta go pee though. So
yeah, All right. So I think rounding out both of your answers, exclusivity from, you know, general market operations like this is a TradFi thing. Like you're not going to go rules the options market as an individual retail trader. You can get in, but it's like, in this case, there is an absolute certainty that you can learn it, participate in it, and have transparency in it because it's on chain. And so all this data being on chain takes out the opacity. I'm not sure what the word would be. It makes it not opaque to the market like you're describing, Charles. So I think, if you look at the options market overall, it's a $10.32 billion contracts market in 2022. The loan market, $8.8 billion. So like, these primitives have to come into DeFi because this is what's going to grow the space. And so we're talking about the comparison of TradFi to DeFi. Like, this is the next wave of actually bringing in real legitimate capital and you know, tripling our market cap as like an actual sector, becoming, you know, one of the 12 sectors of actual, you know, finance.
Yeah. Shout out VX Cozy. I think they're on the Premia team, although I'm not sure, but they're very involved in Premia. Glad to see you here, sir or ma'am. So shout out Cozy. Anyone with a VX in front of the name will be probably a premium person.
All right, so we're at hour nine, guys. Like, I'm you left me with not a lot of time. So here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna do this as quickly and as comprehensively as I can and try to do a good job, and let's see if I can pull it off or not. And that'll be the fun part. So,
see, as you can see, the more you fuck around, the more you're gonna find out.
This is the best.
It was a good segue because we talked about liquid state derivatives, and there was comments on yesterday's show about Frax FRX ETH versus SFRX ETH, and confusion in the market as to what they do. And so, I will do my best to break that down. Like, look, here's the bottom line on Frax. They are, in my opinion, pretty like absolutely game changing. Like the guy, Sam Kazmanian, if you listen to him speak, if you understand his understanding of traditional finance systems, of central banking systems, the guy is a genius, honestly. Like that's where I would peg him in this sort of the space overall, right? So Frax itself, live on 13 chains. They are built like a central bank. And they have all the primitives in DeFi that you need to be successful as a central bank. And I'll lay a couple of those out. And then we'll go into the staking side of staked ETH as it relates to them specifically. But what's interesting about them is what I found very interesting is during the stablecoin DPEG, they were the only ones that didn't have a massive, horrible deviation. They went down to 0.964. Like that is pretty damn good compared to what you saw with across a lot of the other stable coins. You know, their market cap is only $1 billion compared to, how big is USDC, Austin? It's massive.
I have no idea, but it's big. Okay. You can pull it up right there. It'll tell you.
Yeah. But I'm not, we're in the interest of time. We're chugging along here. So effectively, DAI and Frax are really the only two stable coins that didn't break dramatically during the DPEG. And so it speaks a lot about the methodology of what they're put together on how they approach their stablecoin in Frax itself. And so they began, like their life began as a fractional reserve stablecoin or fractional stablecoin protocol, which is not to be sort of mislabeled or misunderstood as an algorithmic stablecoin, Terra Luna. Luna was always 0% collateral ratioed and it failed. This is a bit different, and we're not going to go into like the true semantics of the stablecoin itself, but you can deposit collateral. It's now 100% collateralized as a stablecoin. So it's transitioned away from this, its sort of roots of a fractional.
What is it collateralized with, though, just to be clear?
USDC. And I think there's one other choice as well. Let's see.
Okay, so we all see the risk in that, right?
Yeah. So I mean,
okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you go to Mint, where's Mint? Right here. Yeah, I mean, obviously, so the inherent risk is that a USDC DPEG happens, and it looks like you can use Fae as well. It's the same inherent risk that DAI would face or any of them, right? Like, obviously, that's where you're taking the conversation. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. With the recent day DEI, well, they had a smart contract risk, but like, and never mind, keep going. I was going to mention it, but who cares?
Yeah. But their approach obviously has worked well, and it comes back to this AMO engine that they have, which effectively, like again, not to go too far down the stablecoin side of things. But their algorithmic market operations seem to work. Like the things that they have in place from an algorithmic perspective to get this thing back to peg seems to work well based on what we saw with the actual legitimate DPEG of USDC. So albeit that you are minting USDC to mint Frax, it seems to work pretty well based on the results of what they had. But
so are they doing, they're doing their own market making? They're not relying on the market to keep it at a dollar, or are they just supporting the market with this?
They've got a bunch of different, like you can basically deposit all these different pairs and borrow against them with Frax Lend, and then they have Frax Swap. So they've got a lending market, which, with credit facilities, so on-chain debt, and a swap market, so ways to rebalance with Curve and Frax Swap pools. So they kind of have two different ways, plus the AMO thing, the AMO stuff that they put in the market as well plays a role in that. As well. So it's complex in terms of how they keep peg, but it's obviously been a good model. Sam believes that scaling stables needs to have at least one real world asset behind it. That's why they went to the 100% collateralization ratio. And so I think that they're basically starting to look at getting T-bills or Fed Reserve, you know, treasuries behind Frax as well. And DAI is 130% collateralized. So in reality, like Frax is still more capital efficient at 100% as far as the stablecoin. So really interesting stuff that they're building on the stablecoin side. As far as FRX ETH is concerned, you know, we were talking about liquid stake derivatives and there's a lot of confusion, but it's really, it goes back to like this identity of Frax, which is build all products around being the best stablecoin. And like, that is really like the mantra of what Frax has built. And so for FRX ETH, which is, let me see if I can grab it here. So effectively you will deposit your ETH and you will get back an Ether pegged stablecoin. So FRX ETH is pegged to one Ethereum. It's currently being incentivized. So there's some APR on it, but long-term there's not going to be rewards. So like it's basically turning Ethereum into a pegged stablecoin. And that's going to make sense for kind of like, as I continue the explanation, but like, does that make sense just at its base? Like FRX ETH is a one-to-one peg stablecoin to Ethereum's price.
So it's not a stablecoin. It's pegged to Ethereum.
Yeah, it's pegged to Ethereum, but like
it's not pegged to a dollar like a stablecoin.
Right. It's pegged.
It mirrors the price of Ethereum.
It's a stable Correct. Ethereum.
Okay, so Correct. It's a non-interest-bearing wrapped form of Ethereum.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
So if we go over to the FRX ETH price, yes. And so basically, like, you know, I think that so basically, you know, you can. It's pegged to Ethereum. Initially, it's not going to have incentives and there's no rewards, but like there needs to be a stablecoin issuance. Like basically everybody else is incentivizing you to, to use their liquid stake derivative. Like Lido is going to pay you an interest rate in this end game. Like you need to have at least one token that you can hold at spot that pays you no incentive. That just generates organic demand because it's pegged to a legitimate asset. And so
question for you real quick, Clay. Yeah. You got the wheels turning now. There must be a reason to hold this aside from just holding Ethereum on the one hand.
Yeah.
Okay. Because Ethereum earns you yield everywhere. Now, on the other hand, there must be a reason for Frax to want to issue this, or else they wouldn't do it. So my question is, are they taking the underlying Ethereum and generating yield on it and thereby supporting their stable coin, or what's going on here?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. So one, the stable coin, which is obviously pegged to one ETH. So that changes the unit of accounting. Like it's hard to kind of wrap your head around that. Like this is a unit of accounting now, like it's a pegged asset. And so it can replace like wrapped ETH, like long-term. The end game is like you wouldn't need wrapped ETH. You can use FRX ETH instead of wrapped ETH. So like it gets rid of the bridge game, all that kind of stuff. Like
hold on. What do you mean it gets rid of the bridge game?
Like you can
why would we need to replace wrapped ETH? Because wrapped ETH, I'm sorry, I'm taking the contrarian view here, but I'm really interested in what you're explaining. I just want to understand it. Wrapped ETH only exists to give you an asset that's on the ERC-20 standard that can interact with smart contracts because your base token cannot. So why does that need to be replaced?
I mean, I think that it does form an Ethereum peg stablecoin. Like that is the idea. Like this creates a new medium of exchange that, you know, needs no incentives for you to hold it. Like USDC doesn't pay you to hold it.
Right. But the dollar exists offline, right? So if I want to get my actual real dollars onto the chain, I've got USDC for that. Ethereum does not exist offline. It only exists online. So I'm already on chain. So what's the benefit? That's my, I'm not trolling you. I'm legit. These are questions that are coming to mind. I'm like, well, what's there? And my point in asking this is I know there's a really good reason because Frax is badass. I just want to like uncover what it is because it's got to be there. We're missing it somewhere.
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to like, you need at least one token that you can hold at spot. Like if we think about the long game, like Lido is forced to pay you an interest rate. Like you can take this FRX ETH and go use it for liquidity farming. Like you can use it for anything you'd like, and it generates organic demand. The next step is that you take it and put it into a stable stablecoin, or you put it into the SFRX ETH deposit, like proof of stake vault, and that's how you generate rewards. So it's got two different functionalities. Like they're building functionality into a pegged, you know, asset, and then into a liquid stake derivative asset. So like you can do two completely separate things with them.
No, I get that, but there's an extra step here. Like, there, why would they take all the time to develop Frax Ether, right? When all it really, it's just a wrapped form of ETH. We already have wrapped ETH, and you can already hold Ether and get 100 times the yield opportunities than you're going to get with Frax Ether. So like, what is the point? There's got to be one.
So
there has to be a point to support Frax. That's my point, is like what, right, Bull Bear is saying here. They must be using this underneath to earn rewards to support Frax, so the stable coin.
So Frax puts 10% of ETH and FRX ETH curve
there
pools.
It is.
Yeah.
Okay. And well, FRX that's ETH, just to keep the peg.
Yeah. But that's, but it also makes a lot of sense, because like long term, you want to have like, you want to separate the assets so you can use one, like the use cases are different. Like you can hold it as idle, you can use it as payments for something. You can send it to someone as ETH. You can use it like in market as an, you know, as part of an LP pair. Like there's a bunch of different use cases that you can do that a simple liquid stake derivative wouldn't allow you to do. Like they're incentivizing you to come in and hold, you know, Rocket Pool's version of the LSD. But in this mm-hmm. case, you can hold this thing, it's pegged to Ethereum, and then you can turn it into an LSD if you want. So it's got like two very different functionalities, I think.
So you get additional yield sources built into Frax ETH, right? Is what I'm getting.
No, that's what he was saying. There's no yield on Frax ETH whatsoever. It's literally just a wrapped version of Ethereum. So to me, it just seems like an extra step. And I'm sure we're missing the point. I'm missing the point. I missed the point all the time.
John Stepp says they control a large portion of the curve pool, and they made Frax ETH the main pair for all their liquid staking derivatives using their voting power. And that increases the demand for Frax ETH.
Okay, so here it is. There it is. All right. So all of the deposited ETH earn staking rewards, but those rewards are mostly paid to the staked Frax ETH holders, giving much larger yield.
We fucked around and then we found out.
Yeah, so their staked Frax ETH is not getting staked with a validator.
Right. The minted 10% ETH that's going staked to the curve pool.
Okay. All right. I still don't see it as like a novel thing when we've got all the, we've got wrapped ETH, so that's not a big deal. And then we've got all these liquid stake derivatives, the biggest of which is ST ETH, which has the most liquidity. It's on every single chain. So it would be hard to compete without a real value proposition. Why would I take my ETH and wrap it into this? There must be an increased yield somewhere. That's where I was driving at. It has to be there or nobody would do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happens when liquid stake derivative yield like runs out? What
do you mean? The yield is coming from the Ethereum network,
right? But like eventually there will be a day that there are no more rewards. No,
then there is no more Ethereum validators, sir. So we got a much bigger problem on our hands when that happens. Right. I'm trying to really dive down into the purpose here, and I'm going to research it after this.
Well, I mean,
I believe there's a really good one.
I believe it's to create a stable pegged asset around Ethereum to use as a form of currency. Like out, like you've got to get your head out of just the form of that there can only be one type of stable coin, which is pegged to a dollar.
Ethereum serves an identical purpose if it's not to wrap it into the ERC-20 standard to interact with smart contracts.
I mean, they seem to think that holding it as an idle asset has value in the long term.
Well, I'm interested. I'm gonna go research this.
I think it's, they're just sort of separating the interest from the volatile asset. And it just gives them a lot more flexibility in terms of people being incentivized to stake, get staking yield, and people being incentivized to get farming yield. And I think, they hold a huge position in Curve, and they can direct Curve emissions to FRX ETH pools. The Got more it. People that are outside of the SFRX, the more people that are in FRX rather than SFRX, the yield for SFRX goes up.
So then if people go back to the SFRX, then it's like all their farming opportunities with FRX are then going up. So the market's going to converge at some sort of balance between FRX and SFRX. It just gives them a lot more flexibility. What did I say before? Flexibility.
Well, there's external incentivization going on here. That's the crux that I was missing. They hold a large curve position and they can, that's like if the Ethereum Foundation held a shitload of curve and they said, hey, we got this wrapped ETH over here. We know it doesn't do anything different, but we're going to send yield into that. So if you want this yield, you got to hold this asset. That makes way more sense to me.
Yeah. And then that on top of Frax shares, them incentivizing Frax shares towards farming opportunities with FRX ETH.
But it leaves a delta. It leaves a certain amount of people that leave it in FRX ETH, and then that additional yield goes to the stakers, and so the stakers are making out like bandits as opposed to ST ETH. Now I get it. Exactly. Thank you for the explanation. I will yield back my time.
I think they've got a good point though. Like without the they've enabled a flywheel that's completely different than the typical liquid stake derivative.
It is. It's cool. You
know, competitor out there, and it generates organic demand for the FRX ETH, pegged asset, and it's completely different than what's being done by any of the other competitors. So, there's ways that I think in the future that the change of unit of accounting is actually going to holding it as an idle asset is going to enable you to do different things, whether it be LP or enter the curve pool or et cetera, that are completely outside of the competition. So they have the idea of being a central bank is it's obviously very core to everything that they're building. And so it's pretty, I think what they've done is super impressive. And I'll be interested to see. They're the fastest growing LSD right now. Because of the way that they're set up, I think. I mean, it is an extra step, but it also gives you a ton more utility.
Very cool. Thank you for explaining that, man. I wasn't quite getting it. Now I can see. But really, now at the end of the day, the entire use case for this comes down from Frax Foundation or whatever they're called, because they have to keep that yield pumping to keep this going. But it makes a lot of sense in the way that they did it, and it's very unique. So good for them. I like it.
Well, I mean, on a video I saw recently, Sam did say at some point FRX ETH is going to be pegged to one ETH. There's going to be no rewards, no interest, Ethereum peg stable, no withdrawals. Like it is literally going to be exactly that. And so they see a bigger, we should have Sam on the show to explain how they see a bigger picture in changing the unit of accounting to be FRX ETH and why it's better than wrapped ETH, because that is their goal. They're actively going to different marketplaces and replacing wrapped ETH with FRX ETH.
Right. Let's say I'm holding Phantom, right? And I pull that Phantom off of Equalizer. It's going to deposit wrapped Phantom into my wallet. I immediately get out of wrapped Phantom and put it into Phantom. Why?
Right.
Because nobody's going to siphon that Phantom out because I forgot an approval somewhere on a malicious website, or the contract has built in it that they can turn that off. You know what I mean? Like that standard is a ledger of accounting that's different from a base token. ETH is the base token. That's why North Korea hacks your ETH, because you can't suck it back out like you can with USDC.
Well, I think that's the point of this entire thing is once it's converted, it is backed one-to-one and it cannot be reversed.
Yeah, but backing is not abilities of a smart contract, right? Most of these smart contracts have a burn function, they have a mint function, they have a freeze function. They have many functions which are not conducive to your assets 100% staying safe with no back doors in them, right? Smart contracts often have that built into the token itself, is my point. So when you wrap it, you're opening yourself up to what's ever in the smart contract.
Yeah.
Whatever risks are there.
So we would have to assume with the statement that Sam made, which is that it's pegged 1-to-1 to ETH, no rewards, no interest, and no withdrawals, that there are no functions like what you're describing in the smart contract.
Would
have to
it would obviously have to be verified, but
yeah. But that has to be like if it is a stable pegged asset, like that would have to be the
function. Let's take Day, for example, right? Yeah. Day is essentially, it was wrapped USDC. How do they get hacked? Somebody exploited their burn function within the smart contract. that's a function that is right. that is off. And in this case, because you're minting it with ETH, and then you know you're probably burning your Frax ETH back to ETH. That's how Comet will say stable. It has to have a mint burn function. You're opened up to smart contract risk. Period. So now I'm adding risk for no yield. There must be significant yield. We're getting way off topic here.
There are no withdrawals, Austin. You cannot. It is irreversible.
There's no one-way street.
No going back.
There's no going.
I'm trying to tell you, goddamn it.
Well, then this is a bit even bigger problem because it's a peg risk. If there's no going back, then your arbitragers are not going to come in and ensure it keeps peg.
Well, we're gonna have Sam on, and we'll have him. We'll have him explain the methodology.
We're getting all down
we've
the rabbit
open the
hole
door
here. Yeah.
To a hour long Frax specific deep dive.
I'm sure this the answers are very play. Clear, but these are all like when you start talking, these are the questions that are running through my head as somebody that's being security conscious is how can I get screwed in this transaction? Because it happens.
Yep.
And these are all the ways.
All right. Well, we've set a record time for a Daily Show episode, an hour and 30 minutes. And I think this is probably where we need to cap it off. Happy DeFi Tuesday. For all of you who have stuck with us up to this point, you are awesome. We love you. Hit the like button, subscribe to the channel. If you are sitting in a cubicle somewhere, tap your colleague to the right. Tell them to pull up the Daily Show, watch it with you. It's more fun that way. We will double the number. And Mikey, play the Block Bytes outro and let's get the heck out of here.
That's my game.
That's that heat. Y'all should be throwing it up at home right now. Around the clock. Block bite, smash the like, keep it locked. Block bite, breaking it down. Block. Wait, he's gonna eat the apple in a second. You ready? Here it comes. Block bite, crypto news around the clock. Block bite, smash the like, keep it locked. Block bite. Oh, he didn't do it.
There we go.